Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar's brutal Medellin cartel was responsible for trafficking tons of cocaine to North America and Europe in the 1980s and 90s. The nation became a war zone as his sicarios mercilessly murdered thousands of people, competitors, police, and civilians, to ensure he remained Colombia's reigning kingpin. With billions in personal income, Pablo Escobar bought off politicians and lawmen and became a hero to poorer communities by building houses and sports centers. He was nearly untouchable despite the efforts of the Colombian National Police to bring him to justice. But Pablo Escobar was also one of America's most wanted, and the Drug Enforcement Administration was determined to see him pay for his crimes. Agents Steve Murphy and Javier Pena were assigned to a joint Colombian-U.S. task force created to end Escobar's reign of terror. For 18 months between July 1992 and December 1993, Steve and Javier lived and worked beside Colombian authorities, finding themselves in the crosshairs of sicarios targeting them for the $300,000 bounty Escobar placed on each of their heads. Undeterred, they risked the dangers relentlessly and ruthlessly separating the drug lord from his resources and allies and tearing apart his empire, leaving him underground and on the run from enemies on both sides of the law. Their book, Manhunters, presents Steve and Javier's history in law enforcement, from their rigorous physical training and their early DEA assignments in Miami and Austin to Escobar's mission in Medellin, Colombia, living far from home and serving as frontline soldiers in the never-ending war on drugs that continues to devastate America. This is the real story from the actual DEA agents portrayed in the hit Netflix original series, Narcos. Stephen Murphy and Javier Pena, next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning in. That is why we continue to grow. You're sharing it with your family and friends, and we sure do appreciate it. If you love this show and other shows, head over to iTunes. Give us that 5-star rating, and we thank you so much. A big shout out to the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for doing that. You do what most cannot or won't. You are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Such an honor to be partnered with a great company like Detecticam. Their amazing technology detects illicit drugs, explosives, and it all fits in the palm of your hand. I wish I had this technology when I was a young officer, but you can have it now. If you head over to the website, cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Detecticam. Click their link, go to their site, and see how they can help keep your troops safer. Folks, if you love coffee, and I know a lot of you do, you're going to love the products from Four Sigmatic, from everything from coffee to cocos to elixirs. They have it all. I'm a huge fan of the Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. It doesn't taste like mushrooms. It tastes like regular coffee, and I think it's better for you. It gives me that zip and energy to get through the day. If you love coffee, again, you got to try Four Sigmatic. You can find them on the website, cjevolution.com. You're going to get 15% off using the promo code CJEVO. On to the show with Stephen Murphy and Javier Pena. You are going to love it. Next. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I am very excited, and you will be too. I have two special agents from the DEA, retired, who helped take down Pablo Escobar. Steve Murphy and Javier Pena, welcome, both of you.
Hey, Patrick. Thanks for having us on the show, buddy.
Oh, thank you, man. It's an honor. I read the book, and it's going to be linked up in the show notes, but Manhunters, it's an amazing book. Again, everybody should go out and get it, especially law enforcement. And I always want to ask Leos, you know, retired or currently serving, why did you get into law enforcement? I know, because I read the book, but could you tell the audience? Let's start, Steve, with you, sir.
Well, you know, Patrick, since I was just a little kid, I had a run-in with the cops at a very early age.
Like most kids?
Yeah. And you know what? The cops were allowed to use common sense back then.
What is that?
Yeah, exactly. So it impressed me. And ever since I've been about 10 years old, I never wanted to do anything other than be a cop, you know, and thank the good man upstairs. I got to fulfill that dream. And you know, You've heard that saying, you find a job you like, you never work a day in your life.
Exactly.
Javier and I believe we found that job.
Yeah. And you were drawn into the, dope or drug enforcement early on, Steve, in your career. I mean, just drawn to it.
I was always interested in it. And, yeah. And I got to tell you a quick story because this just happened. When I was a rookie police officer, less than a year on the job, I was off that day and I hooked up with a friend of mine, Jackie Walters, who was a police officer. And we had an informant that told us about a guy that wanted to sell a pound of weed. Now, this was 1976, so a pound of weed in southern West Virginia, that was a lot of dope back then. Mm-hmm. We set this whole thing up, and sure enough, the guy showed up with him. We popped out from the back room and arrested him. We were 17 years old. Make a real long story short, we cut the guy a break. You know, we called his dad. His dad beat the crap out of him, which is kind of nice when it happens like that. And just last week, I got an email from the guy. And
wow.
He said, you probably don't remember me. And I did, honestly, I didn't remember his name, but I did remember the incident. And he said, I just wanted to thank you for cutting me a break. And now he's got a professional job. I won't tell you where he lives or what he does or anything, but he was thanking me for cutting him a break all these years ago. Now we don't cut a lot of people breaks, but 17-year-old made a mistake and it's all worked out for us. I just thought that was a real interesting story. It was great to hear from this kid from.
Well, isn't it amazing? You guys know, I mean, it's so cool when you make an impact like that, because people remember it. Obviously this gentleman did, reached out to you years later. And I think he hit it on the head, Steve. I mean, officers don't have that much discretion anymore to make those decisions, especially in this politically correct world we live in right now. Right. But just great story. Javier, what about you, buddy?
Yeah, how'd you get into it? I was going to college, of course. You know, I was working at night at the sheriff's office in Laredo, Texas. And I'd get off the night shift. I think we'd get off at 7, so I'd be in class at 8 a.m. That was hard. You know, I think my classes were from 8 to 12 o'clock at noon. And I'd go home. I was staying with my grandmother. So I'd sleep all day, go back to work. And, back then it was, 77. I started with the sheriff's office. So the pay was like really bad. It was like $10,000 a year. And then all of a sudden there was an announcement on the bulletin board where DEA was hiring. They were paying $17,000 a year.
Wow.
And I didn't even know what DEA was. You know, I wasn't interested. I just said, man, hey, there's a good paying job. And I applied and had to find out what DEA was, asking people what it was all about. And when I came on, you know, my idea was to spend a couple of years with DEA, go back to the sheriff's office. But after 30 years with DEA, I retired. So I think I liked.
Now, you both had different assignments, you know, everywhere. But how did you get hooked on the assignment or assigned to go after Pablo Escobar?
JP, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I was in Austin. I did 4 years. And then when I put in I put in for Mexico. And there was a mistake. You know, my boss says, Javier, did you put in for Colombia? I said, no, sir. Well, you're going to Colombia. I said, okay. So I get there, and it was just all by chance. My boss knew me from Texas. He had been assigned to Colombia now. He was the head man, Joe Top. And he said, Javier, I'm going to assign you the Pablo Escobar investigation. This was 1988. So, you know, had several partners before Steve. And then long story short, when Pablo surrendered, you know, then all of a sudden, then Steve, then you came in, right?
About what was the week he surrendered, right?
Yeah. And then obviously Steve and I hooked up and the rest is pretty much history, the way we, you know, then we started working Pablo Escobar after the escape. So it was basically, we were assigned the case, not that I want to work it. Mm-hmm. I want to go after him. It's just, hey, Pena, you're assigned to it. Then Steve came over. Steve, you're assigned the case. So that's basically how it worked out.
And I don't know, I mean, if a lot of people realize this, but Escobar was, I mean, I know you guys do, and maybe some listeners, he was a multi-billionaire. I mean, at one point, this guy was making, $400 million a week? So that buys a lot of influence, right? I mean, it was a cat and mouse game for both of you trying to catch this guy. I mean, he bought off everybody. So how do you chase after somebody who's essentially a ghost? I know it's probably intelligence, but can you go into that a little bit?
Well, we were fortunate in the fact that we were working with an elite group of Colombian National Police officers, the Dejín unit. When Pablo escaped from prison, they started out with one colonel, and that wasn't working out too well. So they brought in Colonel Hugo Martinez, who was involved in the first manhunt for Pablo Escobar. He was at that time stationed in Spain. So they brought him back, and as Javier will tell you, that's when they brought the band back together, because they brought some of the original people in there with all the background information, the history associated with them, the knowledge of the organization and the relationships and the properties, and you know everything that goes along with the investigation. These guys had all that background information. So now the other thing was to help avoid corruption during this time. The search block consisted of 600 Colombian National Police officers. None of them were from the Medellin area. So they were all brought in from other parts of the country. That way they didn't have family ties there, friendships and things like that. So that greatly, greatly cut down on corruption or even the potential for corruption. You know, everybody thinks that Colombia is corrupt. And there's a level of corruption, but there's a level of corruption here in the United States as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not anything like people thought it was. It wasn't anywhere near what I thought it was when I got down there. So it was a very, very nice surprise to get there.
I imagine, like everywhere, Steve, like, I mean, most places, I mean, you have the majority of the people are probably good people. They're just, they get that rap, you know, from the many, you know, drug cartel, you know, well, everybody must be wrapped up in it. And that's not the case.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought when I got there.
Now, how did you get, you both get a point to a point where you were flipping informants and you were getting informants? I mean, how did you guys do that? Cause that's what it takes, right? Intelligence.
Yeah. And we had great intelligence coming in. We had the technology. We were doing, you know, it's common fact now, a lot of phone intercepts at that time. And we had, you know, informants coming in. The problem with informants, and you always have to corroborate, you know, it was basic 101 handling informants. A lot of guys would come in, wanted to get paid a lot of money, wanted a new life in the U.S., but they were, you know, they were bullshitting you, basically.
Yeah.
You know, they read the
no.
Paper. Yeah, no, informants don't lie. But anyway, I always had a rule that once you corroborated someone, once you knew they were telling the truth, then obviously we would take care of them. A lot of them wanted money, and a lot of them wanted to come to the U.S. They wanted a new life. They wanted a safe life. We had a couple that were there for revenge. Pablo Escobar screwed them over. So those were the really good ones. But it was just, like I said, the information that came in, the technology, then what really helped out, and I don't think a lot of people realize that, is when we started putting the price on Pablo Escobar, we started offering a reward on Pablo Escobar. It got up to about $5 million. We advertised it, and wow, that was a huge success. We had people calling in, and Steve and I were the majority of we talked to the majority of the call-ins. You know, and like I said, we would meet them somewhere. We didn't bring them into our base. We had a search block going after Pablo Escobar. So a lot of that, you know, like you said, but the money was big for all those informants, the new lifestyle. They wanted to be safe. They, like I said, some of them were revenge from Pablo Escobar.
Yeah.
But again, the main key, and as any law enforcement guy out there knows, it's, you know, it's snitches will lie for you, you know, lie against you, and they'll lie. I mean, you know what I'm saying? You got to corroborate. You got to handle them. You got to, you know, there's no carte blanche. And if they cross that line, you know, they did something wrong, then they got to pay for it, you know?
Yeah. Now, during this time, guys, I mean, how much cocaine coming into the country was Escobar responsible for? I mean, it had to have been a ton of it, right? Or was it all of it, 100% was coming from him, or?
Well, basically, we put the figure at 80%.
Pablo
was responsible for 80%. Remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, mid 80s, Pablo, the Cali cartel had started, you know, had started their own empire, but they were sitting back there. They were learning the mistakes that Pablo Escobar was doing. Cali cartel was smarter than Pablo. Mm-hmm. Pablo was Wild Wild West, where Cali cartel was business type operations. But Pablo cornered the cocaine market, you know, and if you look at, you know, everybody's seen the Scarface movie, that's pretty accurate description of that time frame with the cocaine, the violence, but and the money that was coming back to Pablo Escobar Medellin.
And how big was this guy's ego? I mean, it had to have been insane.
You know what? A few years ago, Javier and I had the, and not bragging, we're just amazed that we got to do this. We had the opportunity to speak at the Sydney Opera House in Australia. Mm-hmm. We sold out the Sydney Opera House.
Wow.
As big as that place is, Pablo's ego wouldn't have fit in that auditorium. That's how big it was.
Oh my God. And that's probably one of the reasons why he got caught too. I mean, he was just he didn't care. I mean, he was just became reckless, right?
Right. Became reckless, didn't care. And you know what? We tell, when we do our presentations, we tell the story. Basically, you know, his escape was a result of his ego. Basically, yeah. You know, he thought there was two guys that were stealing coke from him, and these two guys were his childhood friends. They were the main lieutenants who were doing all the dope while Pablo Escobar was in prison, and it was over some money that they thought, you know, that these guys were hiding from him, and which was not true. And it's just that ego. Here you have a guy who's living in a country club environment, right? He's got the money of the world. He's got not a problem. He's got to do four more years, and he's going to be a free man. But he just could not abide by the rules, could not abide it, and thought they were stealing money from him, which is what led to the killing and obviously led to the famous escape from his prison, which was not a prison.
But I remember that. It was all on the rooftop, you know, with the Colombian National Police. They're the ones that killed him.
Right.
Now, how many deaths was he responsible for, Steve? I mean,
you know, it's a very cloudy number.
Probably because you don't know where some of the deaths, probably.
Right. And so we, in our shows, we attribute maybe 10 to 15, maybe 20,000 deaths that we believe he was responsible for. But up until just a couple months ago, there was one surviving member of his organization, was Sicario named Popeye. And he just passed away a couple months ago. We did a documentary a couple years ago, and we threw that number out there, and then they interviewed him on the same documentary. He says the number is more like 50,000 people that Pablo is responsible
for. Wow. That is crazy.
Mass murder.
Well, of course, yeah, mass murder, narco-terrorist, and that's probably the numbers we know about, right? I mean, there's probably more people.
There's probably more people. You know, on a weekend, we calculate that there'd be 200 to 300 murders in Medellin by itself, just on a weekend, the drive-by shootings with the motorcycle, the sicarios. But if you count, like I said, all the car bomb people who died, the bounties on police officers, thousands, then you count the people on the commercial airline that he bombed, you count the people at the Doss building that he killed. I mean, it adds up, and you know, there are still a lot of unaccounted people that died that we know were killed by Pablo Escobar.
And I know you guys lost a lot of fellow right. officers, you know, during this war. Yeah. Did you guys have any? I know you guys had close calls, you know, yourselves. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, and I told, you know, my main deal was the car bombs. Mm-hmm. You know where he was putting them. He'd come out of the base, and he'd have them on the side of the roads. He'd put them at restaurants, shopping malls, and that was always my, like I said, and I got to experience several, not close, but a little bit away. You see that smoke, you know, then that sound. But then, you know, we would always see the photos, you know, shopping malls, kids, parents. Jeez. It was just, he didn't care. To him, it was numbers. He wanted as many people killed as possible. That way, he could leverage and negotiate his surrender, which worked, basically.
Yeah, amazing. Now, how did Netflix get involved? How did they come to you guys, Steve?
Well, we have a friend in Washington that helped us get started in our speaking business. Mm-hmm. And he introduced me, while we were still in the job, he introduced me to a couple of Hollywood producers in the Washington, D.C. area and you know, thought they might want to do something with their story. And it turns out they both had personal agendas. They wanted to take our story and make political statements out of it.
You
know, and we're all about telling the truth. So we just said thanks, but no thanks. And Javier and I actually discussed it. We were both SAC special agents in charge at the time. And we said, you know what? Nobody really cares about this story. We kind of gave up on the idea. Well, then in February of 2013, I get a phone call from a retired U.S. Marine that we'd worked with in Colombia. Had talked to the guy over 20 years, and he said, hey, there's a producer in Hollywood looking for you guys. And I said, you know, we've been down this road twice. We're not interested, blah, blah, blah. And if you know any retired Marines, that can be a little colorful in their language.
No.
He cleaned me up really good. I said, okay, I'll call the guy. So I called this guy, Eric Newman, and he gave us his pitch. And I turned him down on the phone, I think really shocked him. And so during the conversation, he said, listen, if I come to Washington, bring two writers, would you just have dinner with us? Let us take you to dinner. Let us tell you what our thoughts are. And then if you and Javier say it's no, it's no. And honest to God, you'll understand this because you're a cop. I'm thinking that's going to be a free dinner and a really good restaurant. I said, yes. So,
absolutely.
And so Javier and I, we did our research on this guy. And it was Eric Newman. He's the creator of Narcos. You know, well-educated, comes from a Hollywood background, family. His dad's Randy Newman, who used to write the movies, the jingles for all the movies, the older movies. The two writers, they're all experienced people. And when I met him in the restaurant, our personalities clicked. And after about 2 or 3 hours, we're getting ready to leave. And Eric said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, Javier and I'll discuss it. We'll get back to you. But I think, you know, I'm thinking maybe we'll move forward. Let's just see what happens. That was in March of 13 when we had dinner. 2 months later, Javier and I signed contracts with Netflix. In June, I pulled the pin and retired from DEA. Javier stayed on until January the following year for some other things he had going on. Mm-hmm. But in July of 13, we were sitting in Hollywood starting to work with the writers to write the first season of Narcos.
Wow. And a hit series, obviously. Everybody talks about it. Now, is it like, I'm going to ask a question, and, you know, like any Hollywood production, I mean, is it accurate? I'm sure. Is it accurate enough to satisfy you guys, or is it like, they fluffed it up a little bit?
If you like it, it's all true, man. As you can tell, my nose is drawing here. it's a good series. It's entertaining, and you know, we didn't know, but there's a term that's called artistic licenses. With every show, when you see it's based on a true events, it's based on true events, but you know, how accurate is it? So. Yeah. I'd like to say the chronology of the series is very accurate. You know, the bombing, the surrender, the amount of cocaine, the money, all that stuff. There's other stuff that's, you know, it's called artistic licenses, but it's entertaining. And you know what? You know, when it first came out, you know, I called Steve. I said, man, no one's going to watch this. You know, it's, you know, then all of a sudden we started getting feedback from Netflix, and all of a sudden it was a big phenomenon. You know, it was especially the Europeans, you know, Australia, India, it was a big hit. And, you know, basically that's why they, and just at the beginning it came up, they ordered another series, which is good for us because that's another 10 show. So we get paid for that too. Hey,
Patrick, I got to add on to Javier's comments there. You know, there was some Hollywood added. There's a lot of truth in it, but there's also a lot of Hollywood. But the one thing that is absolutely true is Javier did have all his girlfriends.
Yes. That is true. I get it. You know what, Patrick? That's my number one question. Did I have all those affairs? I said, of course I did. Come on, man.
Well, I think I saw an interview with you, Steve, you were talking about, because your wife was over there, you know, in Colombia with you. And there was a point, I think, in an interview where you said that there were some inaccuracies and I haven't watched the Narcos. I'm going to start watching it, but your wife was asked to leave the country, and that never happened, right?
That's absolutely right. She has stood beside me. You know, I was a cop when I met her back in 1982, I think it was. And I've never done anything else but been a cop. So she's always stood by my side. She's given up her career as a registered nurse multiple times through all the moves we've made. But when they send us this, every time they'd write a script, they'd send it to Javier and I, and we review it. We pick out little inaccuracies or things to make it look a little more authentic, realistic. And because her character was portrayed there, she got to, you know, she had a little sign off on it as well.
Yeah.
And I read that and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to hear about this. So finally she gets it. And about 3 minutes into it, she comes back shaking that thing in my face. She said, did you read the script? You know, I never left you. And I said, baby, I didn't write the stupid thing. Okay.
It's Hollywood.
That's Hollywood. She stood there the whole time. And, you know, it's public knowledge pretty much now that we adopted our two daughters down in Colombia.
Yeah.
And if this is not public knowledge, it's been out a little bit, but if you watch, I think it's episode 10 of season 1 where it shows me getting kidnapped. First, I was never kidnapped. That's Hollywood. But just before the actor pulls in his driveway, he motions for two girls walking along the sidewalk to walk in front of him. Those are our real daughters. That's Monica and Mandy.
Wow. I know at the start of the book there, and I'm not giving it away, but there's a point where you thought you and your wife, Connie, were going to get ambushed, you know, by a group where some people that were following you in a car. A long story short, there's a point where I was laughing because your wife says, "I'll take out one of them if you can take out the other two." I was like, "What a woman!"
her exact words is, "I'll kick his ass if you take care of those two."
But Narcos, you got to check it out. Let's pivot a little bit, guys, really quick. You guys do so much. Besides, you're retired now, but you're still all over the place, talking to people, educating people. What do you think about, let me rephrase, I mean, the current drug-related issues? You guys spend a lot of time in DEA. You know about the fentanyl, opioid crisis. Where are we going with this, guys? I mean, it seems out of control. Now, I spent 23 years in law enforcement, and now cops seems like they're falling over, getting exposed to fentanyl. They're dying. Where are we going with this stuff?
You know, it's just, it amazes me, and I'm sure it does you guys as well. I know it does Javier, that as bad as whatever trending drug is, there's always something else that comes along. I mean, what the heck is going on with fentanyl? Why would the Mexicans send fentanyl up where it's killing their clients? You know, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. A lot of the fentanyl issues are unknown to the users, so they're lacing fentanyl in the weed or in the opioid pills or whatever it might be. They're putting fentanyl in there. Well, we all know, if you know anything at all about fentanyl, it only takes like 3 grains, not grams, grains, like 3 grains of salt to create a potential overdose, depending on what your body makeup is. So there's a lot of danger involved with that. The opioids, don't understand it. You know, I know that everybody wants to blame Big Pharma, and I'm sure they are extremely responsible for touting the wonders of these new drugs. Mm-hmm. But so much so that it got out of control, and now I think we have a lot of addicts on opioids and painkillers that never intended to become addicts. That they, because of the addiction qualities of the drug, while they're taking it for legitimate pain reasons or whatever they're taking it for, became addicted. So what that's led to is, because you know it's an opiate, the heroin that we used to see when you were on the street, you know, the purity of heroin was only like 3 to 4, maybe 5%.
Yeah.
Now you get a hit of heroin on the street, it might be 30%. I mean, it's strong enough that you can smoke it. You don't have to use the needle to inject it, which was always the telltale sign of a heroin addict. I don't understand why people have such a demand and a desire to take these illegal narcotics, because nothing good comes out of any of this. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think, Javier, I saw you in an interview, and I agree with you when you talked about how, you know, we've, as a nation, we've gotten away from educational programs that teach our young kids early on. Not that that's going to solve everything, but I think that's part of the solution. We're not even teaching kids that anymore. I mean, I know when I was a cop, we were teaching them DARE. I think that's what you said in another interview. We got rid of that. So what are we replacing it with? Nothing.
And I'm glad you brought it up. And just before I start with that, what happens to all those cartels? We took out everything. What happened? Cali cartel, right? Took over.
Take one weed out, another one.
Look at the Mexico cartels. You take one out. Look at Chapo. Did that make a difference? It made a difference in that he's arrested, but there's other organizations that have taken their place. As long as there's, you know, we got the demand, there's going to be people that are going to send their dope across. And I'm glad you brought up the programs. We need more. We need to establish that. DARE was working. If you talk to people that had that program, that underwent with it, and I talked to a lot of people, they loved that program. Administration comes up, they stop funding that program. So again, nobody knows what the solutions are. We're not into the legalization, but however, we need to start getting better at our educational process. We were starting to get better, and all of a sudden it went away. So we need education at an early age. We need families, schools, teachers, medical profession, anybody. We need to start getting involved and do a better job with that.
What do you guys think? And you hit it both. I mean, supply and demand, I know. I mean, is it a losing battle with drugs?
You know, We just got an email on our Facebook page yesterday or the day before asking that same question. When are we going to have a drug-free America? Mm-hmm. As much as I'd like to say in 2 years we'll be drug-free, the truth is, as long as there's a demand,
sure.
No, there are tons of criminals out there who provide the supply. It's the basic laws of economics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why we don't understand the demand.
Yeah. And the cartels definitely exploit that.
That's what they do best.
Now, where can people, if they want your book, guys, where can they find more information about you both, your videos, everything?
Well, our website is www.deanarcos.com. You can go on there. You can see there's a ton of stuff on there. And Javier and I did put it together. We have a professional that did it for us. So it looks really nice. But you can see everything from our bios, our stories, to fan photos, to some of our videos, to an interactive calendar, which right now is empty because of the COVID virus. Everything, yeah, yeah. All our book and speaking events have been postponed. But also, you can catch us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Vimeo, YouTube, and LinkedIn, all under DEA Narcos. If you're interested in the book, go to our homepage. Right-click on the book there on the opening page. And for the month, there you go. Nice-looking book you got there.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And for the month of April, we're offering a 15% discount. Got a pretty strong feeling that might carry over into May. And, you know, we know people are stuck at home, and you're always looking for something good to read. And you know, we
watch Narcos.
Watch Narcos. Javier and I kind of promote our book Manhunters as a sure cure for insomnia. So if you're having trouble sleeping, just pick up a copy. And
no, it is an amazing book. I told Javier before you got on, Steve, that I just finished reading it. Amazing book, a must read, not just for Leos, but everybody out there that wants to know the true history of especially young people, you know, heroes like you and others that went out there and hunted this guy down. That's what you have to do. You have to hunt these people down. Any final words before we wrap up, gentlemen?
Before we go, I just want to, like you said, praise one of our guys who just died, Colonel Martinez. He's mentioned in the book. He was really promoted to a general. Hugo Martinez Poveda just died March, I think it was 22nd, of a heart attack. He was the real hero in all of this. He's the one who led the fight against Pablo Escobar. So, again, our sympathy goes out to his family.
Well, Javier Pena, Stephen Murphy, former DEA agent Sachs, both of them. Thank you for your service, both of you. Thank you for your continued work and education. And I wish you both the best of luck in the future. If we could ever do anything, please don't hesitate to ask.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's been a pleasure being on here with you.
Thank you, sir.
Same thing, Patrick. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.